So just with these, and these are just ideas and things you experiment with, but so if you, like if you choose the nostrils and you really kind of want to focus, then you have to be very careful not to get too tight. And so where you'll notice, where I notice tightness is in my eyes, so that I'm trying to see the breath, and in my hands, and in the end of the out-breath. So if I can keep, that, the end of the out-breath really relaxed and stay with it, and then I find the hands have a kind of like a large feeling, the body feels very large, and then the eyes aren't contracted, then that can work well. So you can see that a background body awareness is very important, because the body's indicating how this is working, and samadhi, if it's effective, is going to bring both a relaxed mind and a relaxed body. And then if you have like discomfort, then I think the end of the out-breath is also very good to watch, because with discomfort you have this kind of anticipation and consciousness, you kind of want to get rid of that pain, and you want to get to a place where there is no pain. So you might be, I mean, it's kind of subconscious, it's not so conscious, but you're sort of, what is it, you're sort of kind of moving to the future. So sometimes the future being the end of the sitting, so sometimes the end of the out-breath isn't complete. It's kind of reaching forward. Just suggestions you might look at. But you can see that kind of awareness would keep you in the moment, you know, as you're breathing with the breath. So then the Thai Force tradition, a lot of teachers talk about meditating at the nostrils. Mahasi Sayadaw says, meditate here. And then if you spend all hour figuring out where you're going to meditate, then that's doubt. So it doesn't really matter, right? It doesn't matter so much. And then the other, the Shikantasa, the choiceless awareness, a lot of people find that somehow they relate to that more than to a kind of more focused practice. And so they find that kind of spaciousness is very helpful. So the imagery around there is a space. So if any of you have heard Ajahn Sumedho's teaching, you've heard this, but if we're in this room and we look at the objects, we have the color kind of light green there, we have shapes, we have sound, we have people, right? So those are the objects. To notice the space of the room, what do you have to do? You have to take your attention away from objects. You know, space you can't really define as big or small, right? But you can notice it by taking your attention away from objects. It's a bit more difficult. If I tell you to look at the picture of Ajahn Chah, it's easy. But if I say, just observe space, what do you have to do? Now to observe space, you come to the same kind of consciousness, I think, as listening. And that's, so in that kind of noticing, it's like you're not choosing an object, you're practicing choiceless awareness. And within that, quite often people will notice a kind of, in both practices actually, when the mind is concentrated, sometimes you'll notice a kind of ringing sound, like almost an electronic sound in the background. If you notice that, that's quite an interesting thing to abide with. So for Ajahn Sumedho, he likes to teach that a lot. He calls it the sound of silence. And when your mind relaxes and is not engaged with objects, and it just relaxes into emptiness and silence, quite often you notice this kind of background ringing. And that's a kind of interesting sign, because it's always there. It's not like the sound of the tui which comes and goes according to the tui's karma or mind. Right? I've got a lot of tui's here. But that kind of sound of emptiness is always there when you relax the mind. So if you notice that, that can be interesting. Some teachers will quite often recommend, like if your mind is really quite scattered and it's hard to settle, then you just do things like counting the breaths. A lot of people start their meditation even after 20 years, they start by counting. It's just a very, very simple way to really ground yourself into the present moment. And one way to do it is at the end of each out-breath, you count one and then two, and maybe go up to 10 or 20 or whatever, and each time you lose track, start again. A little punishment, yeah. But that kind of makes you a little more attentive. So that's a simple thing to do, just to stay in the present moment. But you wouldn't want to spend the rest of your life counting your breaths. The awful way to live, right? Life is a... So the preliminary kind of entry into meditation is oftentimes, should we say, coarse or more obvious. So it might be like a deeper breath, it might be counting. That gets you into the game. But most people, when they find, once they practice for some period of time, then one of the questions which comes up is the whole sense of will. And as you practice meditation, you begin to notice, who is this guy that's pushing his breath? You know, there's a kind of sense of me doing this meditation all the time. And that begins to feel too coarse. That begins to feel like there's something not right there. And you begin to actually observe the very sense of someone meditating, the mind turning on the mind. And that's interesting. It's the kind of sense of me doing something. And in that observation, actually a sense of self falls away because you can't find anything, it's only the moment. And so that, the kind of more subtle consideration, but as your mind starts to become more subtle and refined, your interests kind of changes because you notice more things that you maybe didn't notice before. Lompa Sumedho said when he started meditation, his mind was so hopelessly active that he just had to do let go, let go, let go, let go, let go, let go. He couldn't do anything else because his mind just would not stop talking. So let go, let go, let go. Now, this is a different story now. So it really depends on kind of like the way your consciousness has evolved. Your emotions and mental realm, the way you make effort, you know, as a person, and then what you've done this week, what's come up for you. So if you've had something quite complicated and difficult in the family or work, and it's really churned up your emotional world, then choiceless awareness can be quite good, because what you're doing there is you're just allowing the churning to be manifest, but you're not following the storyline, the aversion or the fear or whatever. You're just noticing this churning of energy, of emotion, and you're letting it settle down. Like one kind of really clear example for me was when I was once, my dad had died, my mom was living in Ottawa, I had come from here, I think. I was teaching a 10-day retreat in Toronto, Mum was in Ottawa, and I got a phone call at the end of the retreat that evening that my brother and mother had been in a car accident. The train hit the car. That's the only family I got, right? So, train hits the car, nice image. And that's all the information I had. They were still alive. My mind went berserk. It just went bananas, you know, kind of, wow. It's totally... kind of a primal sense of panic, I don't know what, it was just very, very strong. And there's no way I was going to sit and watch the end of my out-breath. there's just no way. So what I had to do something much more vigorous. And I was in someone's basement flat, I think, and I just walked really vigorously for a good 2 hours, just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and just let this energy come through me. I mean, I did everything I had to do. I tried to phone and I got a ticket the next morning and so on. And they had survived and Mom had a broken shoulder and the car was wiped out. And I asked my brother what happened and so on. But what was really interesting was the strength of emotion. And yet, it was just the way it was. Nothing I could do about it. So you know, someone could come to me and say, criticize me and say, don't you have equanimity? In which case they would get a broken nose, I think. This is sort of, you know, it is what it is. It is what it is. It's just this feeling. So you don't want to get into some kind of control, I think. You know, don't see meditation as always having to do things, because it's more like about being free with the way things are rather than controlling the way things are. But we can direct attention, you know, so I can see my mind just like fantasizing about something which has no kind of real emotional power, it's just habit, and say, no, back to the breath. That's different, because it's just habitual, as opposed to some kind of upwelling of you know, kind of titanic proportions or whatever. So you know the best thing is to not take a position about what's going on, but just have the skill to see, okay, this is how it's going. What can I do now to make the mind more peaceful? So in that vein, like walking meditation, I know when I started, like I ordained as a samanera in Bangkok at Wat Mahathat. Before I met Ajahn Chah, I didn't know about him. And there they taught this very slow and deliberate walking practice of lifting, pushing, touching, lifting, pushing, touching, which I didn't like at all. For some people it worked, but I just found it just too constricting for me. Partly because I was a young guy full of energy and an untrained mind, and I just, you know, it was kind of the energy system. It was kind of holding it too tightly. And then when I went to see Ajahn, to live with Ajahn Chah, take guidance from him, he would kind of joke, he said, well, if you do slow walking, what happens when you have diarrhea? He had a good sense of humor. So he just encouraged, which I found very helpful, just, you know, you can walk slow or fast, it doesn't really matter, but try to get a sense of what kind of energy you have and what's going to be useful. I was talking to one monk in Thailand there, one Western monk, and he's a really big, vigorous guy, and so he usually builds himself like a 30 meter footpath, really long footpath for walking, and he just goes up and down, and he just, you know, because he's got a lot of energy, he's an energetic guy. But sometimes he'll eat, you know, assuming his walking path is safe, he'll actually walk with his eyes closed. It'll get you mindful. So he'll kind of experiment like that. And I found that too with walking, that in our forest practice, the meditation path by the kuti is a very important part of our equipment. Very important part. And Ajahn Chah encouraged us to do a lot of walking meditation. So when we have a really good walking path and we're feeling very calm, you know, very serene, then it's natural just to walk very slowly. But if we're feeling sleepy, you know, then we might just get out on the walking path and do some vigorous walking. If we have a lot of restless energy, we just might walk it off and so on. So that's pretty natural, I think. So do like a walking meditation. If you can have a good walking path in your home. I mean, I know it's harder. You do it in the backyard, the neighbors think you're crazy or something. But it's very good. It's very, very good. So don't think meditation always requires you to sit. Sometimes you come home from work and you don't want to sit or whatever. But if you have a walking path, just walk. And what is the mood of the mind? Get used to that. What is the mood of the mind? And keep letting go of that. That's very helpful. So as we, you know, as we do the walking now, you know, it's kind of constrained the spaces. So like if there are four people walking out, there are five and someone's in a rage and they go back and forth, it's going to freak everyone out. So it's kind of, you're kind of constrained by the social environment. But keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. And if you do, like if something really strong is coming up, then just go around the track. Just walk the track, right? Just let it come out. Because once you, Ajahn Sumedho had a line, which I don't know if he uses so much anymore. He used to, consciousness is the escape hatch. Consciousness escape. So sometimes you something presses a button, as we say, and some kind of emotional material comes into consciousness, and actually there's not much you have to do about it. You just have to bear witness to it until it runs its course. Bearing witness to it is different than running with a narrative and a storyline. So if I've been, say, betrayed by someone, and then 2 years later that whole memory pattern comes up again, and it was really, really strong, then if I go with the storyline, they did this to me and then did that to me, then I feed it. But if I just think, oh, I shouldn't have this, and push it down, then I never liberate it from the mind. So consciousness is the escape hatch. So these things becoming conscious are actually okay. They're okay. If you have the mindfulness and trust to just see, oh, this is just energy, karmic energy. It's sometimes called an old gas. It's coming out of you. And we have that. Yeah, we have that. So there's no kind of, if you have a pattern of meditation always being some kind of controlled, refined thing, then what do you do with that? You think, well, I can't meditate. One of the traps in meditation is refinement. And so like with breath meditation, if you take your attention to the nostrils, you can get very, very refined states of mind. But you'd be careful there, because refinement still is a construct. Awareness is not a construct. Right? So if you find in your meditation you become more and more refined, and then non-refinement annoys you, coarseness annoys you, then okay, there's something there. Yeah? Now, refinement can be very, very good, because it can lead to deep states of samadhi, but they can be quite... you can kind of get very greedy for that. You can say, well, just a bit more refined. You can get annoyed at people because they're breathing too loud. Right? I mean, the things you can get annoyed in a retreat are stunning. Because there's nothing, why do you get annoyed? Because there's nothing else to get annoyed at. You just, that's what annoyance does. It just looks for a target and then zam, it goes for it. So those things are important to indicate. So when we get kind of greedy in our practice, and you get really selfish, and you don't notice it actually. You just, I'm doing this, I'm very serious. And then someone bangs the door and you get ticked off at them. That's known as greed, isn't it? So we all have that, we all feel that. Or you're doing metta practice and someone sneezes and you say, shut up. So it's not about... So if you come back to the central theme, is that the mind knowing the mind is the path, and the result of the path is freedom from suffering, then you just know that, like, if you're meditating and your mind's getting quite tranquil and then something happens, she irritates you, irritation feels this way. Then that irritation is something that deepens your awareness. It takes everything to deepen your awareness, positive or negative.